You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome to this episode of Stay Ahead, where theory meets practice and practice meets theory. Today's episode is a part of the Strategy as Practice series. Today, we have the pleasure to have Øystein Moan, chairman of Visma, and as our guest. And from BI, I'm joined by Professor Helene Coleman. My name is Thomas Borgen, and I'm an industrial PhD candidate at the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at BI. Today, we will talk about mergers and acquisitions. And when we talk about mergers and acquisitions, we tend to think about the difficult process of finding good matches and then doing the actual deal. But maybe the hardest part might be yet to come. But first, Øystein Moan, he joined Visma as CEO back in 1997, actually 1 year after Visma was founded, and remained the CEO for 22 years and transitioned to chairman 18 months ago. Welcome, Øystein.
Thank you.
And then we have Helene Coleman, long-standing faculty member and professor at the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship here at BI. Professor Coleman is recognized as an international scholar, particularly in two fields, that's post-M&A integration and international strategies, where she focused particularly on organizational identity, managerial agency, and capability building. She also does a lot of teaching, which is a major part of what we do at BI, and she focuses on M&A integration and strategic change management. Welcome.
Thank you.
Øystein, are you particularly interested in road biking?
Yes, I think I can say I become quite interested in road biking. Started slowly with Tour de France in the background during the summer vacation, like a lot of us, and gradually becoming more interested. And of course, also biking little myself, just for training, not competition, but I like biking. Then my interest increased a lot 2 years ago as I was seeing a customer in our Dutch subsidiary. We saw a customer called Jumbo, and they presented proudly their professional bicycle team. They were sponsoring Lotto NL Jumbo. And they said, by the way, yesterday Lotto NL told us that they will stop bicycle sponsoring and we have to find a new main sponsor. And I thought about it for about 1.5 seconds and said, I take it. Because we were about to expand our operations to the Benelux areas and to Central Europe. And cycling is one of the biggest sports in the world and one of the few sports where you can actually put your company name on the team itself. So, and what is now Jumbo-Visma is one of the three big cycle teams in the world, competing in the three big competitions, been winning the Vuelta a España 2 years in a row, number two in Tour de France 2 years in a row, a billion people are watching Tour de France on TV. So it's big in Norway and the Nordics, but it's crazy big in Central Europe.
Very, very impressive. Particularly let's call it the decision-making in 12 and a half seconds. We'd like to learn more about that. Do you follow biking or Tour de France, Helene?
Oh, I'm afraid not. I'm not one of those 1 billion people that do follow. But I've seen them ride the bike. I see them fall, and you know.
Have you seen Visma on the back of the riders?
I'm afraid not.
Okay, they were the winner, by the way.
Yeah.
Anyway, Visma received a lot of good exposure during Tour de France and other sport events which you are supporting. But not all listeners may know the impressive facts about your company. So let's go through it. I think it's fair to say that Visma today is one of Europe's largest providers of software solutions for domains such as accounting, financial management, human resources, invoicing and collection, procurement, as well as consulting. I think you define yourself as delivering critical business software for companies of all sizes. Just some hard facts. In 2020, Visma had a turnover of more than 18 billion Norwegian kroner, compared to, less 10 years ago, only 3 billion, which is even a big size. And you grew from 3,000 employees to 12,500 employees just during these 10 years. Value-wise, your latest valuation was set at 16 billion euros. Just for comparison, Norsk Hydro is valued at 13 billion euros and Telenor at 19 billion euros. So you are in a good company when it comes to valuation. So very, very impressive. But Øystein, you have done hundreds of acquisitions and amazing 37 acquisitions only in 2020. You continue to grow in the Nordics and the Dutch markets. You continued the expansion in Eastern Europe and Latin America, and you set the foot in Belgium. So, Øystein, what is the big vision behind all these acquisitions?
Well, we are, I would say, make acquisitions for particularly two reasons these days. One is to expand our market presence and go into new territories. There, we have the last 3-4 years expanded a lot in the Dutch and also now in the Belgian market. Just before the summer, we made our first important acquisition in Spain, which also fits a little with our already holdings in a Spanish-speaking LATAM. So gradually, we're becoming a pan-European operation. And we see that to go into a new market when it comes to accountancy, payroll tax, is so hard organically because the rules in the different markets in Europe are so different. So the best way to enter a new market is to acquire a strong company in that market. So that's one reason why we make acquisitions. The other is about innovation. All large companies have problems with innovation. Not because we are stupid, but we have so much obligations, so much vested interests in what we do already. So all our obligations quite often prevent us from taking new steps. So we have quite systematically tried to acquire a lot of the new technology that we need. And we are not alone in that. We see that Cisco, Microsoft, Google, Apple has also acquired a lot of the technology that is maybe the most important technology these days. So innovation and change combined with entering into new markets are probably the two main reasons why we make all those acquisitions.
I note that you say you're not acquiring companies which are not cloud-based anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's a natural consequence of that everything is moving to the cloud, is it?
Yes, the movement from Windows on-premises to cloud computing started a little 20 years ago, started seriously 10 years ago, and I think the change will be completed in this decade. So, and that's been a very hard transition for the software industry because both the technology and the revenue model and the business models are very different in cloud computing compared to Windows on-premises computing. So, doing that change organically has been very hard for us and for quite a few other software companies. Mm. If you bought the Windows software companies 10 years ago, well, then you could feel that you had quite a few years to make the transition. If you buy a Windows on-premises company now, you may only have 3-4 years before it's end of that era. So if you buy a Windows software company now, you buy yourself a restructuring case and declining revenue case, and maybe a very hard case to restructure. So the last 2 years, we've been quite fundamentalistic about only buying pure play cloud software vendors.
So having such a high acquisition rate, I guess the number of companies you look at is quite large and you pick out certain, maybe based on what you alluded to, the market, that is a new market or expanding the market, or they have certain capabilities. What are you, how do you really go through the process of identifying and then selecting those companies which then hopefully will fit your strategy?
Well, when it comes to sourcing of acquisition targets, I would say first, acquisitions, create acquisitions. We are well known at making acquisitions, so a lot of people come to us, both companies, founders, and also banks and people, advisors who are advising people. Secondly, we have a quite large operations already. We have 14,000 people. We have many hundreds leaders. And the people that are on the ground in different markets, they know who are the worst competitors, who are the upcoming stars, and they will, to a large extent, tell us what companies we shall talk to. So I think our long list of potential targets is around 1,000 companies at any given time. Some are not interested in, and some are not for sale, but quite a few of them are coming out in the market and are available.
Interesting. Helena, listening to a serial acquirer, this CEO for 22 years, now the chairman, what is the research telling us about the opportunities and challenges about being a serial acquirer?
Well, there's several challenges and opportunities when it comes to serial acquirers. So one of the things that research has been trying to look at is it so that when you acquire and you keep on acquiring a sequence of acquisitions, do you actually get better at doing it, or what happens? And if you look at sort of the number of acquisitions that companies make and the performance of them, it's not necessarily a very easy relationship between those two. So the findings are non-conclusive. And there are two alternative explanations for the link between experience and performance. The first one being that if you are a serial acquirer and you continuously have to carry out time-consuming, capacity-demanding change processes, which an acquisition represents, then as these become overlapping, your sort of organization becomes strained and you get what they call indigestion, sort of this biting off more than you can chew. So this is the one idea which can explain, you know, that it's not necessarily so that you become much better. But then we also know that serial acquirers can develop integration capabilities. They can learn to become better at acquiring. So in that sense, we think that serial acquirers may offset the challenges implied by having to carry out all these integration processes by developing the ability to be better at, you know, finding targets, integrating targets, taking out the synergies from these. And these integration capabilities can be found in sort of an M&A function. Some organizations that keep on acquiring have an M&A function where they sort of have that knowledge of their acquisitions. They may codify knowledge and put it into blueprints and manuals, etc. So I like to think of integration capability as sort of a change capacity. It's the capacity to keep on acquiring while you're focusing on your ongoing business without losing sight of your customers and your users, or et cetera. So I think that's
the main point. So let's follow up some of those very useful points. You've been now acquiring since actually the beginning. I think you were just a CEO for 3 or 4 days before you did your first acquisition. Mm-hmm. How what's the learning through these many years?
Yeah, one learning is that integration actually is quite hard. So you better not do too much of it.
And you do 37 a year.
Yes, but how much integration do you actually need to do? Because I know a lot of companies who have very formalistic ideas about integration. Saying, for instance, that if you buy a company, they have to change their ERP system into our big, for instance, SAP ERP system, which of course will be a completely disaster for a small, fast-growing company. Change brand names, change offices, introduce all the big companies' bureaucracy. So we have a quite pragmatic approach to integration, and we have a hybrid view on integration. So a lot of the companies we are acquiring now is fast-growing, entrepreneurial, quite small, but cloud computing companies with good technology, fast growth, but maybe not so large. They may be from 1 to 5 million euros in revenue. And if we come with a large company's sort of structure, bureaucracy, overhead, we are drowning them and we quench the entrepreneur spirit. So many of the companies we acquire, provided that they have good management, good growth, good technology, and that's what the kind of companies we're looking for, we let them continue as separate legal entities. So in many ways, in many areas, we don't integrate at all. They can often keep their name, keep their management, keep their products, keep their offices, keep their go-to-market, because they know their customers. That's reason why they have been successful and fast-growing, and we want to retain those success factors. On the other hand, we integrate very hard on financials. Because if you buy a lot of companies, you better keep very good financial and accounting control. So in Visma, for instance, we insist that on the fifth workday in a new month, we have complete group consolidation. IFRS 16 every month, and a quarter and a year is the same as every month. That is quite hard, or can be quite hard, if you, for instance, insist that everyone change the ERP system. But we don't. We only need to consolidate on a certain level. We don't need micro granularity on consolidation. So rather than having one shared ERP system, we have one big, actually Google Sheet with some SQL databases behind that everyone upload their key numbers into, and we consolidate automatically. So all companies we are acquiring, we help them a little to make possible from the first month they're part of the group to actually get the reporting in on the fifth workday and with the data we need and without the data we don't need. We are quite conscious about that. So we integrate hard on some back office thing like accounting, cybersecurity. If they have a contract with Amazon, we shift them into our large group-based contract so we get better prices. But on the other hand, we let them do their go-to-market, their product development, the management, and their what has been their success factors, we let them keep that. And that makes also the work much less for us. So integration is not so hard for us because we don't overdo integration as I see a lot of other companies are doing.
So if I'm going to simplify, it's saying that basically we have a decentralized business model, but we centralize the backbone, the infrastructure.
Back office is quite often centralized. Front office, go-to-market, product development is decentralized. And that's what the entrepreneurs care about. They don't really care about group consolidation.
But how do you create identity, a common feeling of being a part of the Visma group, if I may use that expression?
Yeah, that's about culture. And that doesn't happen in one day anyway. First, it's important to acquire a company that fits your culture from day one, which have some similarities like entrepreneurial, high-quality, fast-growing tech-savvy software companies. They have a lot of things in common. But still, we don't expect them to be culturally identical to the Visma from day one. So that is, we let them stay on as their own company. Quite often, they keep their brand name. But little by little, particularly if they're interested in bicycling, which they tend to be in Central Europe, a lot of them want to put the Visma brand in front of their own name. Quite soon, we help them with development technologies, with hosting, with cybersecurity. So I would say over typically a 3 years' time, they have grown into becoming a part of us. But we let them come to us. We don't force ourselves on them. And I think that's important. So today, most of the entrepreneurs we have acquired are still managed in Visma. They have become more corporate, part of the Visma culture, but they also maybe been part of shaping their culture. But they have taken the time to come to us, and we have not forced ourselves on them.
Very, very interesting. Helene, I mean, what does research tell us about the need for culture fit between, let's call it, acquired and acquired? And you study a lot of identity after, let's call it, post-MA.
Yeah, well, it's interesting what Eystein is saying about sort of letting them come to you guys. And I think what we do know when you're carrying out an acquisition, you know, when someone hears that they're being acquired, the first things that they start thinking about is, okay, so who are we, who are they, and who will we become after this merger? And sort of being a high status organization that, you know, they know from their bicycling or for whatever, that is one way to facilitate this integration. And I think sort of playing a little hard to get is probably a good choice. But in terms of cultural differences and cultural fit, there are sort of two opposing views. And I think Eystein sort of was mentioning this as well, that they're acquiring companies because they have a certain culture. They have this entrepreneurial spirit. They have something that you actually want to access. So this is in line with the view that, you know, cultural differences will provide learning opportunities, access to new knowledge. By being exposed to organizations with different norms and values, you might actually renew your own organization. Like you said, that, you know, you're actually changing with all these new acquisitions as well. So, you know, you get to shake up the existing culture. Which, of course, can be positive. And then you have the negative side, which is that, you know, cultural differences will lead to communication problems and different types of management styles, et cetera, that will be difficult in interaction. So, but I think at the end of the day, it's not whether or not culture matters, but it's how you treat it in the integration process, how it sort of plays out as the target and acquirer start interacting. So I don't think it's the sort of the cultural differences per se that are that important. But
I agree. But I think one thing we do is that already very early in the process, before we sign any contracts, we are very open with them. What is the Visma culture, for better or worse? We know exactly who we are, not who we should be, but who we actually are. There are some good things and some hard things. We're not a soft organization. We are hard on quite a few things. And we tell them, this is us. And if you don't like that, well, we should stop the process. And we also discussed integration. Who shall be the boss? Shall they be merged? Shall they continue as a separate company? Are the products that shall be discontinued? Are the offices that shall be moved? So we take a lot of those difficult, let's say, prenuptial discussions up front before we sign anything. And I think at least 25% of the processes stops already there, because they don't like what we say, or we find out that it's not really a good cultural fit. They are not agreeing on who we and on how we are, and they would not sort of be happy with us. Then it's much better to stop as early as possible, before we have signed anything, before we have paid anything. So, but of course, then you need to have a lot of processes going. If you have only one acquisition, you need to make 1 year. Well, you tend to do it regardless. But when we have, let's say, 100 processes running at any given time, we can afford to lose a few, because the cultural fit, or there is not agreement about the strategy. Better to find that out and fail as early as possible in the process.
Do you have your own team who does the M&A search and the pre-classification or pre-screening, or is it down to the business leaders in the various division or country managers?
The business leaders are typically identifying potential acquisitions, but we have a team now of 8-10 people who are working full-time on M&A. And they are sitting in a few in Oslo, we have in Helsinki, in Copenhagen, Stockholm, in Amsterdam. So we have quite a good international team now that are actually doing the screening, doing the talks, and with larger processes, our CEO, Merete, is involved, or I'm also involved in this early phase of telling who we are and telling why it's a good thing for them to come to us, rather to go somewhere else.
But then again, the integration has to happen at the operational level within the various business lines. So that's the acquired management and the new management, I presume, who are responsible to do it within the framework you just described.
Yes. After post-acquisition, there will always be some kind of integration, even if the companies continue as their own legal entity. I said on accounting and reporting, financing, cybersecurity. We are, for instance, in Visma using the Google and Gmail, not Microsoft. So everyone who's using Microsoft Office actually has to change to Gmail and Google Apps. We tell them that up front. If you don't want to do that, well, you can come to us. So we lay out the rules, and people can opt out if you don't like it. But we see more and more of the companies acquiring are already sort of on the same technological infrastructure that we are. So, and in those cases, the integration is fairly easy, actually.
You spoke about culture, and you started as a Norwegian company. Mm-hmm. 22 years ago, 23 years ago, or 25 years ago, I guess it's now, and moved into the Nordics, Central Europe, but even Eastern Europe and Latin America. How has that impacted the culture, and how has that challenged or improved the way you integrate new companies?
Well, I think one of the main advantages is that coming from Norway, coming from Oslo, and in the software industry, we know that we are not the natural leaders of the world. It's 1,000 years since Norway was an imperial country. So we are sort of humble and understand that the Norwegian culture is very good in Norway and other cultures are good in other countries. So we are very pragmatic, open, pluralistic companies understand that there are different cultures, but something will always be the same. The quality of a good business, the good accounting, no corruption, what is good software is an universal thing, actually. So something is universal, but other things are national. But I find that there are more things that are common with us and a good cloud business in Buenos Aires than things that are different, actually. So when we are in the industry, we are working with certain technologies. I think there's so much more that are common than what are different.
That's interesting. Helene, from your research, that to do acquisitions in different countries or new territories, is that a complicating factor in being an acquirer?
Well, what we do know is that if we look at sort of the people have studied cultural differences, and obviously they always want to look at performance. How do cultural differences impact performance? They actually see very inconclusive evidence. It seems like cultural differences can be good, cultural difference can be bad, and they cannot mean anything. There's also research that shows that foreign deals actually perform better than domestic deals. So you would sort of say that cultural differences and, you know, what do they mean? But what I think is what Øystein was just saying, that there's actually more things that people have in common than sort of those differences. You know, people are people to a large extent. And I think, too, that coming as a Norwegian firm, what we see what I've seen in sort of the deals that I've looked at, international acquisitions, is that a lot of people perceive sort of this Norwegianness to be a sales point. You know, what do you think of when you think of Norwegian values and norms? It's egalitarian, openness, sort of, and a lot of the things that you were describing to Øystein. So this Norwegian culture can actually be sort of something that's attractive to in some other cultures as well. So
We're not being seen as naive then.
Yeah, Norwegians can be naive.
Yeah.
Certainly. But we are not naive in Visma. We are a hard place, actually. For good, but good people likes it with us, but we are not naive. We are a little paranoid and suspicious, but we are kind and nice as well. But what I think is important is that good, high-quality companies have a lot in common everywhere. Bad companies can be bad in 1,000 different ways. Just like I think it's Tolstoy saying that good families are very similar, but unhappy families, they can be unhappy in lots of different ways. So a good cloud software company in Norway has so much in common with this good company in Barcelona or in Bucharest or in Buenos Aires. So much are common, actually, if they're good, high-quality companies. And if the further away from home you are acquiring, the better companies you must buy, because you know you cannot go to Buenos Aires easily to do a turnaround. So that's maybe why foreign acquisitions sometimes perform better, because everyone knows that I better buy a good company. It's so far away. It must be a good company with good management that can continue on their own. While at home, you think that I can go and buy a crappy company and turn it around because it's in my backyard. So that's maybe the reason.
Because I think I read an interview which you had a couple of years ago that you don't believe in real turnaround acquisitions unless there is some very particular reasons to do that. Is that correct?
I think turnarounds are harder than you think, always. So don't do too many of them. We have done a few. Some have been successful, some have not. I think we only can stomach one turnaround case per year, and maybe not every year even. So if you can avoid doing turnarounds, it's fine, actually. If you can find enough targets that are not turnarounds, better too.
Exactly. Doing all these acquisitions, hundreds of them, and as we alluded to, 37 in 1 year, is there written down a blueprint, or is it more the institutional learning by managers? How do you record the learnings you acquired during the last many years?
Yeah, our M&A team, they have procedures and some blueprints. But this is developing all the time as well. So I think it's also a lot of institutionalized learning. But we also are reporting the different acquisition cohorts, different years. So we are, and since many of the companies remain as separate legal entities, you can actually have good data. If you merge an acquired company into an existing entity, the history disappears and you don't know a couple of years later who did contribute, the existing or the new. But when they are still legal entities, you can really follow them year by year and see how the different cohorts are working and which acquisitions have done well and which didn't work out. So I think we have quite good data on that, and we try to learn. And well, one of the learnings is that we try to stay away from turnarounds, for instance. And we try to stay away from old technology because it's so hard to pay down the tech debt. So that is one of the learnings we have, which is very much written down as well.
So basically you have some key learnings. And within that, I understand it seems that it's more flexible, but you have certain key issues you believe in, certain principle of, let's call it integration. And then it's more up to the existing or new management to take that business going forward. Yes. Is that so? One of the very interesting research you've done, Helena, is looking at a serial acquirer that they have so many processes going on, and you never finish with integrating one company before you take the next one. It seems that Visma doesn't really. Are that focused on integrating the business model, but it's more the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. What does research tell us about the various methodologies you can use in this integration?
So when it comes to integration, so first we have to realize that, you know, that acquisitions are varied. They vary in size. You know, some acquisitions are, you know, many 10,000s of people over, you know, many countries maybe. Others are smaller. They have different motives. So all of these issues, especially the motive, determines what type of integration you need to do. So if, you know, like Øystein was saying, they do it to internationalize, to gain access to markets. And also, like you were implying, that, you know, buying something is better abroad when you need local knowledge that you don't maybe have from before. Access to technologies, access to scale efficiency. So this is sort of the famous integration versus autonomy dilemma. So how much are you to integrate, to take out scale advantages, to get access to knowledge, et cetera? But at the same time, we know that integration is disruptive. Integration might lead to politics and conflicts, and because a lot of times you challenge existing structures, you challenge people's status, whatever. So it's time consuming, it's resource demanding. How much autonomy is required is the other side of it. But when it comes to serial acquirers and how they integrate. I think it's as varied as this. You know, it's.
Yeah, I think the disruptions really happening when you are doing mergers of legal entities. Mm. Suddenly, two CEOs. There are two CEOs, and there will only be one after the merger. Mm-hmm. And that goes through the whole organization. A lot of people are losing their position. A lot of people are doing a lot of politics to remain in position or to win this sort of merger mm-hmm. fight. Mm-hmm. So mergers are difficult, actually. Mm-hmm. And they may happen many years after acquisition. So that's mm-hmm. a different thing than the acquisition itself. Of course, if you buy a turnaround company, then it may make a lot of sense to get rid of all the management team in the company that needs to turn around, merge them into one of your existing operations. That's a hard integration. Mm-hmm. And though they are hard, disruptive, messy, a lot of politics, mm-hmm. Unions, lawsuits, the whole scale of disrupting. But if you buy companies that can stand on their own feet and are growing very well as still separate legal entities, and the management structure remains intact, okay, they have to adapt to some new and maybe some better reporting. And they have to get some advice on how to improve the cybersecurity and some of their hosting. They get access to some better sourcing of, for instance, hosting contracts. Mm. Maybe they get a better brand name and get some nice new colleagues that they can also do some cross-selling with. Those processes are not disruptive at all. Mm. They can be seen quite positive.
Mm. Yeah, so I think it's all about the opportunities that people perceive in the acquisition. And I think one of the things
that's very important. Each acquisition are different, and as you say, you have to tailor-make the integration process to what you want to get out of the acquisition.
Mm. And also we see in a lot of acquisitions that you were talking about sort of getting rid of the management team. But in some acquisitions, they're actually the key to unlocking potential value in the acquisition. So I think if you look at this, at least some larger technology acquisitions that I've looked at, is it's incredibly important to keep the target managers, because not only do they know where the resources are in the firm, especially if it's a larger entity, but they also have the authority to access those resources. So sort of getting target managers on board can be also a very, very important factor in unlocking value.
Absolutely. Management is super important and quite often more important than people understand. But a key to keep the existing management is quite often to keep the legal entity. If someone is CEO, that person, he or she, like to be a CEO, actually. If you merge them into an existing large company, well, the CEO title goes away. And maybe that person then thinks, oh, maybe I shall look for another CEO position because I actually like to be the CEO. Look at Microsoft. They let LinkedIn continue as a separate company. Not many people even know that LinkedIn is owned by Microsoft. So I think we see more of that now, that companies in the past used to do hard integration very early on all levels are now sort of using the same approach as us, recognizing the importance of the management teams and their motivation and their entrepreneurship, and let them continue as a separate legal entity and then gradually let them grow into become family members.
If you now look at the size of Visma, you've grown tremendously. And I think even this, so far this year, you've grown 25% or something compared to last year. Still a very high growth rate. And I'm sure you still do acquisition. But has the disruption of acquisition meant less because the core of the Visma is so big now that it impacts less? Or is it still the same challenges to integrate in your way?
Well, I don't feel that acquisitions are much disruptive, actually. When we bought, for instance, this leading cloud company in Spain, Holded, no one in any other legislations get any disruption. Mm. They were just happy to see that. Actually, we saw that Holded have very good technology, but in some areas they don't have any solutions, and some other Visma companies have solutions. So now a couple of other companies are actually making Spanish version of their software. and can then use that, hold it as a market organization. So that is not disruptive. That is just sort of innovative and growth and positive.
But do you then get the horizontal transfer of knowledge that, for example, your acquisition in Latin America can inspire your Norwegian operation or the other way around, that the people on the, let's call it, the same level talk together?
Yes. In Norway, we have a lot of what we call competence centers. And they are working for all the legal entities at improving their business. For instance, we have a competence center on cybersecurity. We have a competence center at what's called continuous delivery, which is a very important part of modern software development technology. We have a competence center of HR. Some of those small companies don't have a very good HR operation, and recruiting the right people is very important these days. So we help them develop their HR function. So we have 10, 15 of those competence centers that are working for all this, well, sometimes quite small companies that we're acquiring and at helping them on improving their operations.
So that's the way for you to first consolidate and then disseminate, let's call it competence resources.
Yes, and we have also some software components that all can use. For instance, very good machine learning components for reading and understanding documents like invoices. We have identity management, how to manage all the users, login, two-factor authentication, quite difficult technology-wise, but can be used as a generic technology. We have payment solutions towards banks that everyone can use, electronic invoices solution that everyone can use. So we have a good library of world-class technology that all those small companies can actually utilize for free. So, and that is also much appreciated.
So where are you now moving next in the bigger picture? Not very, you don't need to be very concrete, but what's the ambitions now going the next couple of years? Where's my heading?
Well, we are in the end game of moving from Windows to cloud computing. We have around 20% of our revenue is still Windows. That will probably be gone by 25. So we have to convert and upgrade all those customers and discontinue the old Windows software and replace them with cloud software. So that is an important job to do in the next 4 or 5 years. Then we are becoming a pan-European player, at least continental Europe. We mostly stay away from the Anglo-Saxon world. The software world, at least in the Western part of the world, is divided very much into the Anglo-Saxon markets and the continental Europe markets. In the Anglo-Saxon markets, they have the same language, very much the same accounting and tax rules, and strong American, British, or Australian players. They have big trouble enter continental Europe because the legal systems, accounting and tax systems are so different. So we are wanting to be the champions of the non-Anglo-Saxon part of the Western world, which means EU, EES, and we have also then picked up Spanish-speaking LATAM because it's a large market, 800 million people, with very much the same accounting and tax rules in addition to the language. So that's enough space for us to expand in the next 10 years, actually.
Good luck with that. But yeah. Listening to Øystein, Helena, with having such a great success on most parameters, if not all parameters, at least we can look at today. What does research tell us when a company gets complacent? Say that we have succeeded, but at the same time, we need to be cautious about the next step, going into new markets. Does research tell us anything about that?
Let me try to answer that. Now, so in the context of M&As, you know, we would say that, you know, once you've learned how to acquire and integrate, you know, then that might be a challenge if the context changes tremendously. But then at the same time, I think from what Eitan is describing, they've gone through so many acquisitions that they've probably experienced a lot of the different contexts that are there. But that would be a challenge, like if something totally new came up and your recipe wouldn't work anymore. But more than that, I would be sort of interesting in looking at, you know, seeing how you have been able to pace and time these acquisitions, how you've been able to, you know, draw learnings from the acquisitions that you can utilize in the next one. So that's
Yeah, but you know, in the software industry, it's hard to get complacent. We are even this year we have around 2.1 billion euros revenue. We still are a small company when you have competitors like SAP, Microsoft, Oracle, and so on. And you feel a pressure of an ever-changing industry when new things are coming, new technologies, lots of new disruptions all the time. So you don't get complacent. You are on the edge all the time and worried about the big competitors all the time.
Because the market can be described as you have some major players and then a lot of fragmented players, and you're trying to consolidate. That some sort of role? Is that how we should
read? Sort of, but it's so much entrepreneurship in the software industry, so many new companies. And three, four people with a good education, they can and good ideas, they can establish a new software company, put it on Amazon, and in a couple of years have a great new application out there. So we both have pressure from the large global players and from all the startups in all the markets. So it's a very dynamic place. Lots of things are happening. And if you are falling asleep, you are in trouble. And we feel that continuous pressure of change and all the dynamic in this market all the time.
And as a side note, actually one of the themes which Helene is teaching at BI is strategic change management. The constant need to change and be adaptable. But it's also a question when do you need stability? And I think that's the theme in itself. But in your industry, I guess it's always to be on the edge. That's how I read you.
Yes, but what I say is that if you do not have dynamic qualities, you will not grow. But if you don't have static quality, you will not last. So you have to find a right mixture of changes and also take time to let thing work. And you need some patience to make, for instance, a new ERP software. You typically need 10 years before you reach break even. On the other hand, such a software can live for 50 years. It's a mixture of fast changes and long thinking at the same time. Mixture of changes and also keep the good things static. And it's always easy to fall in, well, sort of the ditch on either side of the road. Either become stagnant and too static or change so much that everything become a chaos. So you have to find a middle ground between dynamic qualities and static qualities.
How does that fit with your thinking, Helena?
No, I think it's a very good good way of putting it. I think this balance between stability and change is something that all firms sort of struggle with at different levels. And I think one of the things that you were saying earlier about that I interpreted as being about your identity and who you are as a firm and keeping continuity in that so that you're sort of staying true to who you are, I think is one of the things that might be very valuable, a valuable asset as a serial acquirer, because people know who you are and what you stand for. And then, yeah.
I think that was a very fine note to kind of wrap up this conversation. I think it was very fascinating what Visma as a Norwegian company has been able to achieve during the last 25 years. It's impressive. You have high ambitions and not at least have a great success both on the customer side and on the employee side. And I think we as academians, we can learn a lot from what Eitan told us and bring it with us further. And it will be fascinating to study Visma going forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. It would be a very, very exciting case of studying integration capabilities.
Exactly. So thank you very much for you, Eitan, and
you.
Your whole team. And thank you, Helena, for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.